Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States is nearing 1 million cases of COVID-19. According to Johns Hopkins, there are currently over 989,000 cases in this country. Tragically, 56,256 people have died. So far, less than 5.6 million people have been tested in the United States. In his recent piece for The Nation called Testing, Testing, 1-2-3 Testing, today's guest, Greg Gonzalez, writes, the United States will need to test tens of millions of people for the presence of the virus in this next phase of the response. We need to be testing 2 million to 3 million a week. Some of this is due to shortages of tests, reagents, nasal swabs, and the people necessary for such a massive testing campaign, as well as the leadership crisis. Experts say we cannot begin to talk about reopening until we have widespread testing. Yesterday, public health officials in six Bay Area counties, including San Francisco, announced a stay-at-home order extension through the end of May. Other cities like Chicago and New York have also extended their shelter-in-place mandates, but states like Georgia and Texas are slowly reopening. So where does that leave the country as a whole? Joining us to talk about these issues is Dr. Greg Gonzalez, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Greg Gonzalez is also a weekly contributor to The Nation magazine. Greg co-founded the Treatment Action Group, for which he won a MacArthur Fellowship in 2018. He has been an AIDS activist for more than 30 years and was a leading member of ACT UP. Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
No problem, Rose. Glad to be here.
Well, I have to ask you, Greg, it's April 28th, and we have been doing shows about testing for a couple of months, and I feel like I'm still asking the same question over and over again. Why is it taking so long to ramp up testing?
So, you know, it's not rocket science. South Korea, Germany, dozens of other countries have figured out how to start testing earlier and in a more comprehensive fashion than the United States has. You know, the White House testing plan largely places responsibility on the states, and that the White House and the federal government are the supplier of last resort, but that's not how it works, right? These testing supplies, not just the sort of discrete PCR reagents that you need for a test specific to COVID-19, but the nasal swabs, the RNA extraction solutions, the test tubes, the people you need to do it, all of this requires sort of a concerted, comprehensive, coordinated effort to scale up industrial production, right? So we can have all the commodities that we need, and then to funnel money to the states so that local and state health departments can hire the people they need to do the testing, you know, input the samples, get the results out to the people who need them. But, you know, the White House has been weirdly nonchalant about the testing effort ever since the beginning of the pandemic. And we still are not testing enough people. Nobody seems to be taking it with the requisite seriousness. That being said, there are governors in lots of states, including California, including my state of Connecticut, that are trying to sort of figure a way forward. But other states are saying, you know what, we'll just open up. We don't care. We don't need to test to the levels that people are expecting us to. We'll open businesses. We don't care if we have states, our hospitals are still filled with people who have COVID-19, and they're sort of running straight against sort of best public health advice. So it's a little bit of chaos out there.
Yeah, and we've done a lot of shows with various epidemiologists and doctors about what we're facing. The New York Times just had a piece, and they report that it has proved hard to increase the production of reagents, the sensitive chemical ingredients that detect whether the virus is present, partly because of federal regulations intended to ensure safety, and partly because manufacturers who usually produce them in small batches have been reluctant to invest in new capacity without assurance that the surge in demand will be sustained. And then you've got the physical components of the test. We've heard now a lot about the nasal swabs. These are largely imported, and they're very hard to come by because every country needs these. So at this point, Greg, what can the federal government do to ensure that states have the tests that they need and the ability to actually ensure that the labs give us the results?
So we're not asking anybody to put a man on the moon or a woman on the moon. The point is we're asking for a scale-up to test the reagents, the commodities, and for Congress to appropriate money to the states and cities around the country so they can hire the people to do the work. The president has to take this seriously. He has to say to these companies, yeah, we will guarantee that you will get paid for scaling up reagent production. And if not, we'll nationalize the process and do it on our own. I mean, the point is that the president could act today. He could have acted a week ago. He could have acted a month ago. But nobody has really seemed to be in charge at the White House. And so we're in the situation where it's not a question of whether we can do it. It's the fact that there's no actual political appetite or desire to do it. And, you know, this goes a little bit for the Congress as well, which is put a lot of money into sort of economic rescue for lots of companies around the country, but not very much into the public health response. And to be fair, I think the Senate has been the sort of stumbling block on this. But I don't understand why this is the case. It's baffling to me.
Well, right. And we had Miles O'Brien on the show last week, a frontline correspondent, and that team did an amazing job of turning around a documentary very quickly about what happened in Washington State. And I asked Miles O'Brien, you know, and I'd love to ask you this question. You said that the administration has no appetite to do this. Why? Miles O'Brien said no one in the administration would talk to him, so he couldn't answer that question. What are your thoughts?
You know, to try to understand what's going on in the sort of chaos at the White House is really hard to do. I mean, you know, for a few weeks, Jared Kushner was in charge of his own sort of skunk works within the White House with his own team of people thinking about how they're going to sort of respond to the coronavirus pandemic. Then there was the task force. You know, on any given day, scientists are either pushed out front to talk about the pandemic or they're sort of told that they shouldn't be talking to the press. There's really no scientific or managerial leadership happening in the White House on this. There's no coronavirus czar. I mean, even though Vice President Pence is supposed to be nominally in charge of the effort, he's very much attuned to sort of keeping the president happy rather than sort of taking charge and sort of leading us out of a crisis. It's not that difficult. One person needs to be in charge, given the line authority to make decisions, direct access to the president to say, we're going to scale up the tests, we're going to scale up the reagents, we're going to scale up the swabs, we're going to do what we need to do this. It's not a question of American know-how or capability. It's a question of political leadership and sort of a management failure where, you know, governors around the country are saying, we need more tests, we need more help. And, you know, the White House is saying, no, you don't. No, you don't. I mean, I don't understand it. It's just baffling to me.
And just yesterday, we learned at the latest press conference, and I'm reading from CNN here, the White House says that the federal government should act as the supplier of last resort for the tests as it works with states to ramp up a new testing regime. States should develop testing plans and rapid response programs and maximize the use of all available testing platforms and venues. This is according to a blueprint report from the White House. So at this point, this just came out yesterday, the states are basically in charge.
You know, look, we know that public health in the United States operates at the local and state level. It's clear that it's my state health department in Connecticut and my local health department in New Haven that will be running the tests and setting up the protocols and figuring out where to do the testing. The main point is that the scale up of commodities that we've discussed, the test tubes, the swabs, the RNA extraction kits, the primers, all the stuff that needs to be done sort of on a global scale and on a national scale, and the sort of central appropriation from the Congress has to happen. You know, for the White House to wash their hands of it and just to think that they can sort of wish away the pandemic as more and more states start to chomp at the bit to reopen, it's irresponsible in a way that is unfathomable right now. It is so deeply irresponsible and catastrophic to public health. We're going to see many, many more deaths than we would need to see. We're going to delay our opening in the states that sort of are following public health advice because the White House can't get it together.
Greg, can you talk about how epidemiologists and doctors and experts like yourself are coming up with numbers. So in the Nation piece, you're calling for 2 to 3 million tests a week. The Guardian had a piece about testing, and in that piece, they cited Harvard's Safra Center for Ethics. They're calling for tens of millions of tests every day. So how are you all coming up with these numbers?
So it's a question of like the bare minimum and then what we really, really love to do, right? You know, we're testing about, as of last week when I wrote that piece, or 2 weeks ago when I wrote the piece, we're about 150,000 tests per day, a little bit over a million a week. And the early discussions are about 2 to 3 million tests a week to get us started. But if we're going to start to sort of go out into the community and, you know, start to test many, many people to understand what the sort of scope is of our epidemics from coast to coast, north to south, east to west, and retesting people, we are going to need in the tens of millions of tests. It's pretty clear when you think of the idea that we have about a million cases in the United States so far, and those are the ones we know about. There's probably several million more, at least, cases out there, maybe, you know, maybe upwards of five times, I don't know, 10 times more that have not yet been detected. If we're going to start to sort of understand the scope of our epidemic, state by state, town by town, and across the country, we're going to need a whole lot more tests. You know, the 2 to 3 million was sort of the bare minimum that some of the reports about reopening were suggesting we needed. But, you know, the point is that we are so far below even the lower bound, the sort of bare minimum of tests we need, that it's that Americans have a right to be worried about what's going on in terms of our public health response across the country.
And The Guardian reports that not one of the 50 states is currently in a position to carry out tracking of infections on the scale needed. Even New York is still experiencing testing shortages 12 weeks after the first case was recorded. Greg, can you just give us basic information about how states get their hands on these tests? I mean, we've heard about the labs that are conducting the test and how they're trying to ramp up. And again, the New York Times reports that some of the labs have been slow to add equipment. And then, you know, some of these companies want to make sure that the surge in demand will be sustained. So is part of this because some of the companies don't know if this will continue to be profitable? I'm still just trying to get basic questions answered.
Well, I mean, some of the companies apparently were worried about how much they'd be getting reimbursed for the tests. And I think, you know, I think CMS and the federal agencies that reimburse, at least through some of our public programs, are saying, yeah, you will get paid what you want for the tests. The point is that the private sector is the private sector, and they're looking out for their own interests. This is, again, why we need national leadership to say, I, as President of the United States, am going to ask all private entities doing tests, public labs, to coordinate a nationwide testing campaign. We're gonna not be the supplier of last resort. We're going to be the people who build the industrial capacity, get the testing reagents and the testing supplies together, and then we'll figure out how to get them to the people who need them most. You know, as one of the governors said, it's like, you know, right now it's like going on eBay with 50 different governors trying to get the supplies you need. People are ordering, you know, supplies from all over the place. It's totally chaotic. And it's, you know, we're not sort of trying to understand a deep, you know, convoluted mystery. Again, this could be fixed tomorrow. It could be addressed tomorrow with real leadership. You basically have had a White House that's basically checked out, totally, absolutely checked out on the need for testing. They just say, in our reality, it doesn't exist that the states need more tests. They can do what they want. We will you know, help them in at the last resort, as you said. But it's just sort of gross negligence at a scale, you know, I don't think anybody could sort of forgive.
Can you also talk about how, under your plan, for example, at the bare minimum, 2 to 3 million people would need to be tested? Something that Dr. Fauci said on CNN a couple months ago still sticks with me. He said that if you are tested positive for COVID-19, in order to ensure that you're negative, you need 2 additional tests over the course of 48 hours. So that would be 3 tests for one person who tests positive. And I haven't really heard much more about that. Can you talk about that?
So first of all, it's not my plan that suggested 2 to 3 million tests. There were sort of estimates by some of the reports, early reports about staging or withdrawal from sort of drastic social distancing measures suggested we needed 2 to 3 million tests. But remember, if I test for coronavirus today and I'm negative, I go to the grocery store and, you know, I'm wearing my mask, I'm wearing my gloves, but I get exposed. My test today is not going to tell me whether I'm infected tomorrow. So to know that you're negative is sort of an ongoing struggle, right? The reason we're social distancing is to minimize our contacts. But if we're opening up the economy over the next few weeks and months, we're going to need more than one test as people sort of resume sort of more risky activities, you know, going back to the office, you know, potentially in places like Georgia, being in restaurants and in barbershops. Just because you had a negative test today doesn't mean tomorrow or next week you're going to be negative still.
Okay, and then what about people who test positive?
Well, if people test positive, you know, first of all, there's a chance that the test could be wrong. You could get a false negative test from some of these PCR tests. So if you have symptoms of the disease, you know, you should act as if you have been exposed and stay home and isolate. But if you test positive, you are going to be. It means you're carrying the virus. You're actively able to transmit the virus, and that means, you know, you need to be home, or if you're very, very ill, you need to go to the emergency room and be checked into a hospital. But if you're positive on one of these PCR tests, it means you're carrying virus. You have an active infection.
Okay, because in your piece you write that, and you just said this, not all tests, either for the virus or the antibodies to it, are created equal. That's a really important point.
Yeah, so the PCR tests are pretty good, and to do, you know, if you think of the HIV example, if you get a initial positive test, they do a confirmatory test. You know, the PCR tests are not perfect, but they're pretty good in picking up active infections. The antibody test, it's the Wild West, because we really don't know what having antibodies means. Is it protective? Is it not protective? If it's protective, for how long? Not all people who've experienced COVID-19 necessarily developed neutralizing antibody responses. There's been some serosurveys in China, and I think another one in Europe that suggested maybe 20 to 30% have very low levels of antibodies, and a smaller percentage, maybe 5% or so, have no antibodies whatsoever. So the idea that antibody tests are ready for prime time in the U.S. is not credible. I mean, the FDA gave emergency use authorization to a bunch of companies saying you can do your in-house validation procedures and get them out on the market, but not many, or if at all, of the antibody tests have been sort of evaluated rigorously by the FDA yet. And so the idea that they're going to provide some assurances to us that it's safe for us to go back because, quote unquote, we have an antibody response is probably a little bit premature to say.
Yeah, Politico reported that the FDA is dealing with a flood of inaccurate coronavirus antibody tests after it allowed more than 120 manufacturers and labs to bring the test to market without an agency review. Why did they do that?
One is, you know, it's an emergency. They want to sort of get stuff out there. But it starts to go back to the sort of original questions we have. What is the strategy? You know, yeah, okay, so make an emergency use authorization, but now you have absolute chaos. Where is the FDA in terms of setting a process to sort of start to evaluate these in real time and put some sort of order into the sort of, you know, big sort of confusion about what antibody tests are doing on the American market? You know, in my piece, I talked about how Chicago had bought like 10,000 antibody tests from South Korea, you know, that hadn't even been seen by the FDA yet. So, you know, there's a little bit of sort of wild west going on, which again sort of leads you back to the question of like, who's in charge? Who's minding the store?
Well, and then to add to the uncertainty of these tests, the New York Times had a piece, let's see, it was just a couple days ago, a team of scientists worked around the clock to evaluate 14 antibody tests. A few worked as advertised, but most did not. Only 3 delivered consistently reliable results, and even the best tests had some flaws.
Yeah, this is consistent with what I wrote in my piece. I mean, basically, we're just understanding the immune response to the coronavirus right now. I mean, it has cousins like the original SARS virus and other sort of more common coronaviruses, but we're trying to understand what having antibodies means, how many people will have them, how protective they'll be. And then that's just the biology of the disease and the immune response. Then you have the tests, and the tests are going to have false negatives and false positives. They have their sensitivity and specificities, as they get called, and sort of the way we evaluate them. But all of that needs to be sort of data needs to be assembled and put through the FDA, and we need to sort of start sorting the wheat from the chaff, because unless there's some sort of rational framework put on to how we're going to use these tests, you are going to have cities and states sort of fending for themselves, and going on the internet and buying 10,000 tests from South Korea sight unseen, with nobody on the U.S. side being able to evaluate them for their utility.
Today we're speaking with Greg Gonsalves, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Greg recently wrote a piece for The Nation called Testing, Testing, 1, 2, 3, Testing. He writes, we need to be testing 2 to 3 million people a week. Greg, you said this was based on a study. Can you tell us more about that study or where we can find it?
So there have been a couple of roadmaps for getting us out of the sort of severe lockdown we have in right now, one by the American Enterprise Institute, the other by the Center for American Progress, all talked about scaling up testing. As you said, a new Harvard study came out that suggested it would be 10 to 20 million, and we need to be doing this on a much grander scale. I think the main piece is not to get hung up on the sort of estimates of the amount of testing we're doing, because we're doing far fewer than we really need to do to get us to that place where we can understand our local epidemics. Just again, think of the number of people we have infected, the sort of occult infections that we don't know about that are happening in our communities. Not everybody we test on any given day is going to be positive. We're doing sort of a huge detective work over the next few weeks and months as we try to understand our epidemics, and it's going to mean millions of tests, whether it's 2 or 3, whether it's 4 to 5, whether it's 5 to 10, 10 to 20. Right now we're doing a little bit more than 1 million a week, which is far less than we need to do.
Based on where we are right now, and given the challenges that these states face in trying to get basic things like swabs, when do you think we'll get to the point of doing 2 to 3 million tests a week?
Again, will big states like California and New York be able to sort of figure out some game plan with their, with their neighbors? In the Northeast here, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, I think Delaware and New Jersey are sort of tied together and trying to figure this out as a sort of regional team. I think the same thing's happening on the West Coast with Oregon, Washington, and California, same in the Midwest. I think what you're seeing is states starting to federate in a very, colonial era situation where they're banding together to figure out how to solve a problem which usually the federal government would tackle. And so I don't know when we're going to see the requisite number of tests on the market to get us where we need to be. Right now, we're sort of in a holding pattern. Everybody wants to know, when are we going to be able to stop social distancing? I want to know we're going to be able to stop social distancing. But I think what we all know is that it's going to take, a scale up of testing, then contact tracing, right? Testing is only the first step. Then we're going to need to do contact tracing and isolation of of those who are infected. There's a whole sort of set of steps that testing is the first stepping stone on. And so we have a very sort of long road ahead of us in terms of figuring out how we're going to reopen safely across the country. Some governors are just going to decide to do it no matter what. It's probably going to set us up for a resurgence in infections in these states and hobble our national efforts to contain the epidemic over the long term.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Greg Gonsalves, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. He's a weekly contributor to The Nation magazine. You can find his piece about the importance of testing at yourcallradio.org. You can also find another piece he wrote with his colleague, Amy. Can you pronounce your last name for me, Greg?
Kapczynski.
Thank you. Amy Kapczynski for the Boston Review called The New Politics of Care. You can find those pieces at yourcallradio.org. Greg has been an AIDS activist for more than 30 years. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or a question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz about how the U.S. government has handled this crisis. He says the U.S. is on course for a second Great Depression. We'll also speak with Thea Lee, president of the Economy Policy Institute, about why millions of people, workers, have been unable to collect unemployment benefits, what systemic changes are needed to tackle these issues. And I should say that if you are an independent contractor, if you're self-employed or you're a gig worker, today you can apply for unemployment benefits. And here in the state of California, the EDD is opening up a section of their office to specifically help you. So that is today. And we will bring you some updates about that tomorrow. On today's show, we are talking about the importance of testing with Greg Gonsalves, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. In his recent piece for The Nation, he says that we need to be testing 2 to 3 million people a week. Over at the Harvard Safra Center for Ethics, they say tens of millions of tests need to happen every single day. Well, right now, less than 5.6 million people have been tested in the United States. If you have a comment or a question for Greg, a question about testing, antibody testing, and contact tracing, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Greg, before we go and get some questions from listeners about antibody and contact tracing, I want to ask you about how we should treat hotspots. So we've been doing shows about meat processing workers at the Smithfield plant in South Dakota, where over 800 employees tested positive. Sadly, now we know that thousands of people working in slaughterhouses have tested positive across the country, and these meat processing plants have shut down. How should these hotspots be dealt with?
Well, look, we know that it's not just meat processing plants. There are nursing homes. There's lots of places that, because of the nature of the work that happens there, the enclosed proximity, where people can't telecommute like many of us are doing, there are going to be hot spots of transmission. And, you know, when we scale up testing, those are going to be the first places we go to look for these sort of hidden cases I've been talking about, the ones that we don't know about, right? But I think because they're congregate settings where people are in close proximity to each other, we're going to go there first. We're also going to go to places like grocery stores and other places that there's high traffic through, because we can assume that these are the places where social distancing is sort of passed by and passed over by virtue of the need to keep these places open. And so these are some of the hotspots we know about. What do we do about the hotspots we don't know about? You know, will certain apartment buildings turn out to be hotspots? Will certain neighborhoods turn out to be hotspots? That we don't know the answer to that, and we're going to end up having to do random testing and other kinds of sort of exploratory testing to figure out we're beyond sort of the obvious hotspots. New infections may sort of reside in our communities.
You have also said that without extreme social distancing, we're going to unleash the virus and potentially collapse our health systems. You say that we cannot relax social distancing without risking a conflagration. So now I wonder, what are your thoughts about the packed beaches that we're seeing? Once Georgia opened its tattoo parlors, for example, I saw a video of someone getting a tattoo on Friday. This woman, Erin Strine, posted a Facebook video of a packed American Airlines flight on Saturday from New York City to Charlotte. Not everyone was wearing masks. So what are your thoughts about all of this?
So one is that... I don't think we need extreme social distancing. We need social distancing and responsible behavior as we try to figure our way out of the current crisis. As I said, we're going to need to test millions of people, and whether it's 2 to 3 million that were in some of the early estimates or the sort of larger estimates you're discussing that have come out of the group at Harvard, we're going to need to understand our epidemics, right? Opening up Connecticut or California or Florida or Georgia needs to be done responsibly in a way that tells us what we're looking at. Otherwise, we're flying blind. Then we're going to need to contact everybody who has been exposed by known cases and isolate them in a responsible and humane way. And then we can start to think about lessening social distancing. Nobody wants social distancing to go on for forever and ever, and nobody expects it to, and nobody thinks it should. The point is that, you know, opening up the beaches in Florida, you know, opening up, you know, hair salons and barbershops in Atlanta, opening up tattoo parlors in Oklahoma or Texas is a recipe for disaster, because none of the states have sort of been able to, you know, Georgia in particular has not seen a two-week or more resolution in case numbers. They've not done the sort of requisite number of testing or had any sort of rigorous contact tracing and isolation in place. So they're just basically saying, what the hell, let's just open up the state and see what happens. But we know what will happen, right? You know, WHO has said this, the World Health Organization has said this, and others have said this, that we're going to see a resurgence of virus in these places that have decided to sort of damn the torpedoes full steam ahead and move ahead without being able to say that, look, we've had our hospital cases have cleared, our ICU beds are nearly empty, we've done thousands and thousands, millions and millions of tests, we know where our infections are, and we can start to open up. Doing it before then basically it makes things worse. It makes, in the long run, it's going to make things more difficult for all of us because, you know, the virus doesn't respect borders. We go back and forth between states and cities all the time. And, you know, my colleague Carlos Del Rio from Emory University in Georgia said, you know, having one or two states or half a dozen states open up for business and relaxing social distancing is like having a peeing section in a swimming pool. It doesn't work. Right. It's going to diffuse the infection all across the country, even into states that have been responsible so far in trying to address the epidemic in a responsible, humane way.
WSB-TV in Atlanta has a piece in which they quote Georgia Tech Health System Engineering Professor Turgay Ehr. He says, we observe and we see as many as 20,000 deaths by the end of August. This is according to a computer research model that predicts the possibility of a second wave of infections and deaths this summer in Georgia.
It's possible. I mean, there's a New York Times article a couple of days ago that talked about sort of that the decision by Governor Kemp to relax social distancing in sort of an extreme way, just basically sort of open up the floodgates, was happening at a time where their infections aren't going down. So they have a epidemic which is flourishing in the state. They're opening up businesses, and yeah, so like, you know, will Georgia be the new New York? Could very well be the case that, you know, that the epicenter of the American coronavirus epidemic starts to move to the south and to some of these Midwestern states that have heretofore been sort of think they're spared of the brunt of it.
We have a question from Michael. Can you comment on Sweden's approach of not distancing and counting on developing herd immunity?
Well, I think I saw a graph earlier this morning. Sweden is seeing thousands of cases, right? You know, they've made some decision that they're willing as a society to take on these deaths as a matter of national sacrifice. I think they're the odd country out. You know, the important thing to think about when you think about Sweden and also other European countries is that they have more robust health systems and safety nets than we do, right? There's also plenty of people in Sweden who are doing social distancing in a voluntary method, but they're not developing herd immunity right now. They're sort of sacrificing hundreds and thousands of people in their population for what, you know, a single scientist or a group of scientists there think is the right way to go. The idea of herd immunity, where you need to get 70 or 80% infected, is something that I don't think anybody in the United States really wants to see happen, because, you know, if we have 70 to 80% of the people infected today or tomorrow or next few months in terms of a Swedish model of trying to sort of develop herd immunity, we're also going to see thousands and thousands of our grandparents and parents and elderly relatives dead from COVID-19. We're going to see, you know, friends who have pre-existing conditions like diabetes or obesity or COPD also in the same sort of gray situation in ICUs on ventilators as well. So the Swedish model is something that we shouldn't aspire to. I think most people think they're making a mistake. I think the Brits and the United Kingdom thought they were going to go this way a little bit a few months ago, but once they sort of saw the projections of deaths that were associated with that kind of a approach, they backed off. And then, you know, a few weeks later, Boris Johnson, who had originally proposed sort of the sort of Swedish model or herd immunity model, sort of was in the hospital himself. So I think it's the Swedish model is not something I think we should be emulating at this point.
And we should note, according to CNN, Sweden has a population of 10 million people. They have just over 18,000 positive cases, 2,274 deaths, and the death rate has now risen significantly higher than many other countries in Europe, more than 22 per 100,000 people in Sweden, according to Johns Hopkins. By contrast, Denmark has just over 7 deaths per 100,000 people. So it's important to point that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that question. If you have a question, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. Today, we're joined by Greg Gonzalez, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. He's a weekly contributor to The Nation. In one of his latest pieces, he says we need to be testing 2 to 3 million people a week. Greg co-founded the Treatment Action Group, for which he won a MacArthur Fellowship in 2018. Let's talk about contact tracing, Greg. You write about this in your piece. First off, just explain to us how this works.
So contact tracing is, so let's say I come down with COVID-19. I get tested and I am positive for the virus. If you're a contact tracer, you're going to say, Greg, can you tell me who you've seen over the past 14 weeks? We'd like to sort of interview them. We're not going to tell them your name, but we need to reach out to them to get them tested to see if they are indeed positive too. And then what they would do is if you were one of my contacts, Rose, they'd go and they'd talk to you and they'd say, yes, did you see Greg this week? Yes, I did. They'd talk about, like, you know, were we face to face? Were we wearing masks? They'd ask, can we test you for COVID for SARS-CoV-2? Then if you were positive, they would test. They'd ask you for your contacts and so on down the line. The whole idea is, think of it as sort of trying to track down the chain of infection, starting with the index case with me. They're going to talk to you. If you're positive, they're going to want to know your contacts. They're going to talk to all your contacts. If there's anybody positive in that group, they're going to go to the next group, and so on and so on and so on. And this is the way we track down all those hidden cases in the community that we don't know about.
And this has worked in countries like China, Germany, and South Korea?
Yeah. I mean, so case detection, contact tracing, and isolation has worked for lots of diseases. Where this first sort of appeared was in like 1870 in Leicester, England, when they were trying to deal with smallpox, and there was a group in Leicester that didn't want sort of the
the other approaches that were being done. They were an anti-vaccination sort of league. But basically, they were able to contain smallpox in Leicester with this sort of detect cases, trace their contacts, isolate their contacts. And it's sort of very old school public health, but we use this all the time. So it's very old school.
And so you write about the importance of this, and NPR wrote about this also. They actually are trying to contact all 50 states about their contact tracing capacity. They report that an influential group of former government officials released a letter yesterday calling for a contact tracing workforce of 180,000. Other estimates say that we need a range of 100 to 300,000. What are your thoughts based on your reading?
So, Amy Kapczynski and I wrote this piece in Boston Review yesterday called A New Politics of Care. And so we think we need a community health workforce, probably 300,000 just to do contact tracing. But we're going to need testers, right? And contact trace, you know, so you, if you're the contact tracer, you come to my house, you say, Greg, your friend has turned out to be positive. I want to talk to you about your exposure and test you. I might start talking to you about the problems I'm having with rent, or I'm living in an abusive relationship. So contact tracing is not going to be sort of a simple like, hi, let's test you, let's get out of here and go. There's a whole sort of other sort of needs that people are going to have in this epidemic that we're going to need to provide for, because otherwise people aren't going to isolate and social distance, right? And so, you know, so we're going to need contact tracers, 300,000 of them. We're going to need people to do testing. We'll probably need an infection control brigade that goes into workplaces to help them think about how to improve the hygiene there, reconfigure restaurants and other places for maximum social distancing, to make sure that people have masks and other sort of supplies to keep them safe. I do think there's going to be a whole set of people who are going to be like, I can't isolate. I'm a single dad. I have two daughters. I can't sort of be separated from them right now. You're going to need people who are sort of a brigade of social workers to figure out some of that complexity about what it means to isolate, because you test, you contact trace, and then you isolate people who are sick. And it's not simple. In my case, you know, if you were living alone and you were a single person, maybe you could do it and there's no complications. But if you're a single person with a dog or a cat, who's going to feed the dog or the cat? You can see how it becomes a complicated affair. And so we've been talking about sort of a community health worker brigade that has lots of different functions in addition to contact tracing. You know, the important thing is that a lot of people are out of jobs right now. Partners in Health in Massachusetts was asked by Charlie Baker, the governor there, to hire 1,000 contact tracers. 17,000 people applied. They're largely recruiting among communities of color and the unemployed. And there's a huge desire to be part of this and to help. You know, what you need to do contact tracing is to be able to talk to people, gain their trust, and have a little bit of training to do sort of the data collection and recording that you need to do. But, you know, we can train thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to do these basic tasks. Some of these other tasks, which are more sort of social work or advocacy or legal advocacy, you know, may need other people who are paralegals or trained in social work. But, you know, we have millions of people who are unemployed right now. We could put millions back to work with a program that sort of is a new workforce for public health. Remember, one of the problems in this epidemic is that we've seen a 10% cut in the CDC's budget over the past 10 years, you know, preceding President Trump into President Obama's administration. We've seen tens of thousands, over 50,000 local and state public health workers disappear. In many states, we don't even have contact tracing to any real extent that could handle this pandemic. So we have to sort of rebuild from the ground up a sort of foundational public health workforce, both for COVID-19, but also for the rest of the health threats that we're going to face in the years ahead.
Yeah, we should do an entire show about this, Greg, because it is so important. As you point out, we need to hire people to do this work that no app can do. And I think that the social worker aspect of this is so important because, you know, we have so many people who are isolated. Small business owners have no idea what they're going to do because they're not getting grants and loans. People are out of work. I mean, there's so much that really needs to be taken care of.
Yeah, the COVID-19 pandemic has really been an x-ray on who we are as a nation. And, you know, it's not an accident that we have the worst epidemic in the world, because we have a fractured healthcare system that's a patchwork We have a sort of frayed social safety net. And when we're talking about sort of the European experience of this, you know, people are being taken care of. You know, salaries are being supported across the board. People don't have to worry about, you know, losing their health care if they lose their job. Their housing is being subsidized. And so, you know, we've been sort of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, and we're not our brothers and sisters keepers. And that's all well and good for some people, except when you get into a place where we're all interconnected and our risk is all shared, no matter who we are and how much money we make.
We have another email from Stephen who says, when and how will we know when people who've had the virus will be immune? It seems like we still don't know the answer.
So we don't know the answer right now. The point is that we are, what, 6 months into this? Less than 6 months into this. And so knowing like how long – so if I'm exposed today and 3 weeks later I'm better and I have an antibody response – I don't know if it's going to last 2 to 3 years because we haven't had 2 to 3 years of experience with this virus. So we're going to find out over time what kind of immune responses confer immunity and for how long. That's going to be a matter of sort of longitudinal studies of people who've been infected with the virus, looking at the kinds of antibodies they have and looking for potential re-exposures in the community where people have had waning immunity or had transient immunity to begin with. I mean, we've seen some sort of reoccurrences in Korea and in China, but a lot of people have been discussing them as sort of infections that were never cleared in the first place. So we'll figure out who's immune, but it's not something we're going to figure out today and right now. We'll know when you're better from COVID and you're no longer shedding the virus because we can do that with PCR tests. But knowing if the antibody response you have is going to be protective, and for how long, we won't know that for a little bit longer.
What are your thoughts about the next month? What's in store for the next month, Greg? I mean, here in the Bay Area, we now have our shelter-in-place policy extended through May. There's just a patchwork across the country. The CDC finally implemented guidelines for meat processing plants, but I just learned that it's voluntary, unfortunately. JetBlue just announced that people will be required to wear masks. I mean, all of this is coming so late right now, but here we are. So where do you think we're going in the next month in terms of social distancing, protection? Where do you see all of that going?
Well, as I was on the phone with you, I just saw that President Trump said the meatpacking plants have to go back to work. Which is astounding to me. These are places that have been fraught with risk for people. Hundreds of people have been infected and exposed to the virus. I think there are governors on the left and right, Republican and Democrat, are trying to do the right thing. Governors like Governor DeWine, Governor Hogan, and Governor Baker, who are Republican governors in their states of Ohio, Maryland, and Massachusetts, along with a whole bunch of other sort of governors on the Democratic side around the country, were trying to do the right thing. They're trying to enforce social distancing, trying to give people the support they need to get through it, because it's social distancing is a luxury and a privilege for many of us. You know, if it's between putting food on the table and driving your Uber or going to your shift at the supermarket, you don't have the luxury of social distancing. So lots of states are trying to support people to do it as best they can. Everybody's trying to scale up testing, contact tracing, and isolation right now. This is the main thing that I think the responsible governors are trying to figure out, either with themselves and their state legislatures or with their neighboring states. We're going to see more Georgias, more Texases, more Oklahomas, more Nebraskas sort of carelessly opening up and endangering the rest of the country. What's going to happen is that we're all going to have to sort of do cleanup there too. You know, there's been some sense from Senator McConnell that, you know, he's not interested in bailing out New York State in the midst of their fiscal crisis due to COVID-19. What he fails to mention, what Governor Cuomo pointed out, is that, you know, his own state receives much more federal funds than they pay in taxes. And we're going to be, from states like California, New York, and Connecticut, we're going to be sending lots of our tax money to these states that have sort of acted irresponsibly over the past few weeks and into the next few months, and sort of ignoring public health advice. You know, Governor Kemper says he's operating on the data. He's not operating on the data. He's lying to his own constituents and to the rest of the country when he says he's doing this. I have no idea why Governor Kemp, Governor DeSantis, Governor Abbott are making these decisions, because it, you know, you cannot, we either sink or we swim together. And Georgia, Florida, Texas, and other states are going to make us sink like a rock.
Greg, I have to ask you, in addition to all of this great work that you're doing, you're also a media critic. On Twitter, you have criticized the New York Times in the past. One of their articles, for example, I think the headline says it all, "Trump suggests lack of testing is no longer a problem. Governors disagree." So you're calling out the media, and I just wonder, I hope you don't mind me asking, but how are you doing right now?
Like, personally? I mean,
personally, because this is a lot.
I haven't left my house in 2 days. I'm trying to be responsible. It's difficult, but I have it. You know, I work for university. I can do my work on, you know, virtually and continue my daily life. I have it easy. So, you know, but like everybody, you know, it's psychologically and physically stressful to sort of be in this lockdown and think that it's going to go on, you know, not for just the rest of the month of April or May, but could be, even as Deborah Birx is starting to admit in the White House, is saying, you know, it's going to be through the summer at least. And so I think it's really difficult on us. And, you know, I have been critical of the media, because I think, you know, we've talked about how problematic the sort of federal leadership has been on this. And when that article came out in the Times about the president saying there's no problems with testing, but the governors disagree, it was like, one of those statements is true and one is not. There's some amazing health reporters, you know, with Stat News and with some of the big science journals that are putting out amazing, important work for all of us. But there's political reporters who really have, as Margaret Sullivan has said at the Washington Post today, let Trump walk all over them and let them walk all over him in the context of this pandemic.
Greg Gonzalez is co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership and assistant professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Greg also writes for The Nation. You can read his latest piece, Testing, Testing, 123 Testing, at yourcallradio.org. Greg, thanks for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping everything running at the studio. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz about how the U.S. government has handled this crisis. We'll also speak with Thea Lee, president of the Economy Policy Institute. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.